We've got wolfmen and mothmen and swamp men. Oh my.
Danger. He senses danger.
Yes, it's Halloween, and Illinois is full of people seeing fantastic beasts right in their own backyards. You've just got to know where to find them. Plus,
here's Johnny.
We've got scary movie recommendations for after the trick-or-treaters have come and gone. We'll also be talking about the University of Illinois' confidential informant program that uses students to bust drug dealers. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Happy Halloween. If you look around, you're certain to see lots of spooky and scary things wherever you live. Witches, black cats, skeletons. But if you look even closer, you might see something even more terrifying. At least according to some Illinois residents who've reported seeing everything from a giant dragon-like bird that swoops to a swamp ghost. And according to a recent feature in the Chicago Tribune, there may or may not be fantastic beasts all across the state of Illinois. Chris Borelli is a features writer at the Chicago Tribune. He's here with me at our Chicago studios to talk about the feature story he wrote, wrapping all of these up. Hey, Chris, welcome to the 21st. Happy Halloween.
Hi, thanks for having me.
On the line with us, Lauren Coleman and Andy Snyder are also with us. Lauren's the director of the International Cryptozoology Museum in Maine. He's actually a Central Illinois native. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, good to be here today. Happy Halloween.
Thank you. Happy Halloween. Andy's a curator, of herbs and aquatics at Brookfield Zoo. Andy, thanks for being here, too.
Thanks very much. Nice to be here.
Chris, let's start with the fact that you think there's really no place in the state where you're quote-unquote safe when it comes to reports of bizarre species, whether we're talking about a wolfman-type creature on the loose near Champaign or a giant livestock-killing bird in southern Illinois or even a phantom kangaroo in Chicago.
That's an old story.
Does every state maybe have these?
Yeah.
Or do you think?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm from New England, and we have vampires, right? And it's, let's see, Champ in Lake Champlain, Champlain. There's certainly sea serpents off of New England all the time. I mean, every part of the country has its own myths and legends, and monsters are sort of the best ones, I think. I mean, Illinois seems to have more interesting ones, maybe.
Lauren, what do you think? Because you, first of all, I didn't even know that I just learned the whole term of cryptozoology. Can you explain what that is, Lauren?
Cryptozoology is a very formal science. It's the study of hidden or unknown animals. It's a way to find new species. So it's a very technical subdiscipline of zoology. And yes, cryptozoology has formally been around since the 1930s, 1940s. It's just in the last few years it's become television programs and some very good Chicago Tribune features, as well as a museum that has existed now for 14 years.
Right. Well, you're the director of the International Cryptozoology Museum in Maine. The Chicago Tribune has great illustrations of these creatures in Illinois that we're going to get to in a minute. So we've tweeted them out. If you follow 21ST Show, if you want to comment, you can always tag us. That's our handle, 21ST Show. You know, Andy, I want to go to a point that you made in the Tribune story, which is that if you look back on past history, there's actually a lot of fantastic beasts or creatures that we never believed that we now know existed. And I'm thinking of obvious things like dinosaurs or large reptiles.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I said for the article, I don't know if it actually made it in the article, but was that I'm surprised I'm regularly surprised when something new and exciting is found around the world. There's a lot of things out in the oceans that we have never seen yet show up. And Things like oarfish show up on beach that are partially degraded and they look like a sea serpent and various other things. So I'm always surprised pleasantly when we find something new and exciting out there that we didn't know existed, or we can put to rest an old rumor anyway, in some cases, when we figure out what something really is.
Lauren, how does this happen, like, in terms of sightings? Do people call the police? Are these just things people talk about? How does, when people say they've seen things like, in your case, you wrote, there's a creature you've had firsthand experience with, the Enfield Horror. How does, maybe you can tell us about that.
Sure. The Enfield Horror was a creature during the 70s that was seen around Enfield, Illinois. It looked like a hopping kangaroo or some kind of upright primate. And there's many different channels to get this to the public. A lot of media, oftentimes local police, or myself, since I've been doing this for 57 years and have written 40 books on the subject, I've in many ways become a lightning rod where people email me, they go on Twitter, whatever, and they get hold of me, tell me about a new case, and then we send investigators out, or ourselves are able to go out and look into this, because the whole goal is that some of these cryptids, as we call them, may be new species, like the giant squid, the okapi, the mountain gorilla, all started out as folkloric legendary animals that we then eventually discovered.
So let's, I wonder, Chris, there's lots of stories of different ones of different, and this happens all across the state. Let's start with Lake Michigan, because I actually, there,
Lake Michigan sea serpent.
When there's, this is actually Chicago Tribune archives from 1893, I believe.
We have a lot of archives, actually, on this serpent.
Right. Yeah. And so there's a great quote of the sea serpent that was seen. Officers at Fort Sheridan on the North Shore, this is according to Tribune article, said they were so shaken by seeing the sea monsters, they, quote, signed a pledge to let liquor alone.
Yeah, yeah. Which, it's hard to say. I mean, it's funny because some of these old stories, they're written in such a sort of an archaic language at times that you sort of wonder how much.
Is this tongue-in-cheek?
Yeah,
or
how
is
much
this,
tongue-in-cheek right. is there? I mean, the quote. There's a quote I used in the piece, too, from a Tribune story about you know, looking, I looked through my opera glasses and I saw the sea serpent, you know, and this is from Linkin Park. And you almost wonder, you can almost see the reporter having fun with, like, a, you know, a sort of a well-to-do Linkin Park resident, you know, spotting a sea serpent. The one thing I think is kind of a little disappointing, and I sort of make a sort of a quick reference to this, is, you know, I wish it had a name, right? Not to make fun of it, but I wish it had a name. It's just like
the sea serpent.
Yeah, I mean,
Lake
the only thing
Michigan?
I've mentioned, I've seen a little bit of, I've seen it referenced a little bit online as Mishy, but that's not in any of the old Tribune stories, and there hasn't really been many reports of it since the 30s. The last sighting I found in a Tribune article was, I think, 34.
Hmm. So. Okay, so let's go region by region. Lauren, I wonder if you can help us. In the summer of 1977, a 10-year-old boy outside Lincoln, Illinois, was attacked by giant birds. According to reports at the time, he was carried 30 feet and then dropped. Lauren, what do we know about that one?
That's the famous Lawndale, Illinois case where Marla Lowe and a group of people were playing in the yard, and all of a sudden, these two giant condor-like birds swooped down and picked him up, carried him across the yard. His parents, the other children there, started yelling at it, and they dropped, the birds dropped the boy. And then what happened was myself and other investigators interviewed him. The police investigated, sheriff's department, and a whole bunch of other reports from that area came to the fore that this kid had not made this up. His parents didn't make it up. And in fact, then what often happens, he was so ridiculed for the report that his hair, his red hair, turned gray because people started leaving dead birds on their porch to make fun of him. So it's not safe sometimes to tell about your reports because people are so you know, in touch with their own fears that they bring it out on the people that see these creatures.
So, Lorne, how do you handle things when people, are there doubts when people call you and say they see something? Do you ever doubt them?
Well, of course, you have to go into all of these reports skeptically open-minded. Luckily, I have degrees in anthropology, zoology, and psychiatric social work. So I, the only piece of evidence for a lot of these sightings are the people that give those. But most people are really looking for validation. They're not looking for any fame. They're not looking for money. So the hoax is really only about 1%. Most people have a real experience that's extraordinary, and they're just trying to understand it.
I would feel like, Lorne, in this age of social media and everybody having camera phones now, do people give sad pictures of these things?
Well, there's some very bad pictures on YouTube, but if you really think about it, by the time you take your phone out, turn it on, find the application for your camera, these phenomena disappear. It's really very momentary and instantaneous that people are having these sightings. So the phones really aren't the miracle that a lot of people would say that they were expecting. Technology has not actually helped us find or photograph more cryptids.
That's Lorne Coleman. He's the director of the International Cryptozoology Museum in Maine. He's actually a Central Illinois native, and we're talking about these fantastic beasts or creatures that have been spotted folklorically or not throughout Illinois this Halloween. Chris, I wanted to ask you about one of the other, the Murfreesboro mud monster that was spotted in, that's also in the 70s, right?
A lot of these are in the 70s. They're in the early 70s, especially. I mean, not to put too much weight on Lorne here, but I think Lorne knows a lot more about the mud monster than I do. I mean, it's sort of, there's a I don't know if you want to call them a species or a subspecies, but they all seem vaguely resonant of Bigfoot to me. They're just stinkier and white. There's the fur is a little bit different. And the way Lorne, I remember, described it is they're thinner often. They look a little bit more emaciated than the image of the Bigfoot.
Yeah, Lorne, is that how you describe it?
Yeah, they're more like an ape-like, smaller version of Bigfoot. They're very southern Illinois. You know, Egypt, Little Egypt, has a concentration of these creatures that really drew me from Decatur, where I was living, to go to Southern Illinois University in Carbondale for the one specific fact that that was a hotbed of folklore. There's a brand new book coming out that I didn't write, but I was asked to write the foreword to, called The Big Muddy Monster. And so there's also a new brewery festival down there. So you can see this happening all over the country. But Illinois really is taking advantage of what I call crypto tourism in southern Illinois now. And the Big Muddy Monster, I think, is going to be the high point of a lot of activity in the future.
Now, one of the most common cryptozoological species in the state is something the article calls the giant black panther. Lorne, you said you saw one yourself in 1969?
Yes, I was working as a recreational therapist at Anna State Hospital, going to school in Carbondale, and with five of my coworkers, we were coming home late at night and came over one of those rolling hills, and headlights absolutely caught this giant black panther with a typical tail that kind of swoops up. But I was in a situation where I was with coworkers that all they wanted to do was go home and, you know, be with their family, have a beer, whatever. So when we all saw it, I said, you know, let's go back. Let's find the footprints. Let's see if there's traces. And everybody said, no, we're going to go home. So, I was put in the position of being just an ordinary eyewitness that was kind of different than everybody else. I wanted to look for evidence. But there are actually more black panther sightings in Illinois than there are Bigfoot or the giant thunderbirds or any of the other creatures. They're the most common unknown animal that's being seen in Illinois right now.
Andy, when you, I wonder if folks call the Brookfield Zoo and say they see things like a black panther. I don't know if people call you or what you think that might have been.
You know, you wouldn't believe the calls that we get sometimes. I don't know that we've gotten calls about Black Panthers, but that would not certainly surprise me. As I've said in the past, you know, there are cougars that are being found all across the U.S. now in places where they used to occur. And cougar is another word for panther in this area. And the size is something that's very interesting, because oftentimes when we see something, especially briefly, it gets exaggerated in our minds. And so I think that most of the Black Panther calls for Illinois are probably real cats, you know, melanistic, dark-colored cats that are seen and just exaggerated in someone's mind. It's very easy to do, especially when you see it briefly. And I think it's very likely that...
That's Andy Schneider with the Brookfield Zoo talking to us a little bit about folks that call the zoo. I want to thank also Lauren Coleman with the International Cryptozoology Museum in Maine, and Chris Borelli from the Chicago Tribune, whose article inspired this conversation. As I said, they've got some wonderful illustrations Phil Gleb did at the Tribune with all of these stories that kind of packs in all of the different sightings of creatures that have been seen. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me this Halloween to talk about it. I appreciate it.
Great to be here. Welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The idea of informants helping police bust drug dealers is something most people are familiar with. But what about when those informants are college students recruited because of their on-campus drug use? A new report from the Chronicle of Higher Education found that this is happening often and right here in Illinois. The Chronicle looked at confidential informant policies at police departments at the 100 largest public colleges in the country and found that more than half of those campuses had policies that outlined guidelines for these practices. Some of these informants, some campuses used informants like this on an annual basis, including the University of Illinois. What does this mean for students and their families, and is this a beneficial practice? Joining me to talk about this is Lieutenant Joe McCullough from the University of Illinois Police Department's Narcotics and Street Crimes Unit. He's in our studios in Urbana. Lieutenant, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks, Nyla.
Also with me on the line from Massachusetts is an attorney with the firm of Antonio and DeMare. But for more than 35 years, he was the director of student legal services at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. It's Charles DeMare with us. Charles, thanks for being here, too.
Thank you so much.
Lieutenant McCullough, can I start with you and the confidential informant program at the U of I? Can you tell us about how long this has been in place and what sort of the philosophy behind it is for people who might not be familiar with it?
Our philosophy has changed, I would say, in the last decade or so. Traditionally, police officers and narcotics enforcement officers come across to individuals at the lowest point of their life. And one thing for us as a university police department and narcotics unit, what we want to see is just not only justice done, but we want to see some rehabilitation. And we decided to take a community-based approach to our narcotics enforcement. And it's a multifaceted approach. But it also begins with the person that we encounter, you know, whether it's a mid-level drug dealer or a highly addicted user. And before they're vetted as a confidential source, we want to make sure that, one, that they are taken care of, that we offer them a way to be rehabilitated, And, you know, there are just a myriad of ways we can do that. And for me, getting into this profession and how I was raised, I just always had a problem with using an addicted-prone person as a confidential source.
Yeah, I read that. I read that in the article you said you were put off by what you said was sort of sometimes the cynical nature of the use of confidential informants. So I wonder what you did differently now. Can you explain a little bit more about these community-based practices that you say that you guys use?
Sure. So when we come across an individual that wants to, and let me preface it with this, we don't apply any pressure to this program. We have a lot of cases that we're working. It's not worth it to us to make another case based upon somebody's addiction. And so when we come across somebody who is at that point in their life, why would I put that person out as a confidential source, trying to find information for the police or making purchases, if they're in a position where they could get right back on the substance that we're trying to break them free from? So when we come across somebody like that that does have those tendencies, we work with the counseling center, with the university, with their attorney, and that's the thing. When we bring in a person who wants to do this or who has expressed interest in being a source, we want them to verify from a third party or have somebody present with them while we talk to them about this. Sometimes it's a parent will come down with them, but most often than not, most of the times we're going to have them get counsel from an attorney and bring the attorney in so we can explain them the process. And if they're at the point in their life where we feel like if we put them out there, they may get right back on the substance that we're trying to get them off of, we're not going to do that. So we do like an alternative-based approach where we get them into counseling. We pair them with a mentor officer. We work with the state's attorney's office. And sometimes I'll drug test those who are trying to get off it. I want them to have some incentive to stay off it. And I want to tell them, you know, if you're going to work with us on this and, you know, we're not putting you out there as a source, we want to put you through this community-based approach. I want there to be some incentive. Like, we do not want to see you on this substance, and we can reserve the right to drug test you. And it's a very neat process to see.
And, Lieutenant, what substances are we talking about here?
I would say that our biggest problem here in the last couple of years has been prescription drugs and MDMA. Of course, we always have an alcohol.
That's ecstasy.
It is.
Yeah.
Of course, we've always had an alcohol and a cannabis problem in the university, but that's not our focus as a police department right now. It's on our illicit substances and cocaine and MDMA, which is ecstasy.
And so you all involve parents or offer the students legal counsel. Of course, they're in the situation because you all have caught them, right, in being involved in illicit substance or abuse, correct?
Not all have been caught. We have some that'll just come in and volunteer to want to give information.
And how many students are you all, and how big is this program? How many students are we talking about?
In the past, we've had 25 to 30 a year. I don't want to disclose current numbers in the last year or two, just based upon cases that are open. But I would say it's over a couple dozen a year.
Charles, I wanted to bring you into this conversation. We've been speaking with Lieutenant Joe McCullough. He's with the University of Illinois Police Department, the Narcotics and Street Crimes Unit on campus. Charles, for a very long time, you were the Director of Student Legal Services at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. And unfortunately, the part of the story, the Chronicle of Higher Education story, talks about a situation with an informant that's very different than what Lieutenant McCullough has described. It involved a student who died of a heroin overdose. Charles, in this case, this was a student, Eric Sinacori. His parents did not know that he was being used as a police informant. His parents ended up suing the university, alleging the campus was obligated her to inform her of her son's drug activity. What else can you tell her about the case and how this happened at the University of Massachusetts?
Well, again, I don't have any firsthand knowledge about the case. Most of my knowledge about the case comes through the press. And my understanding is, though, that the individual was caught with some marijuana, I believe some ecstasy, maybe some other drugs too, but not opioids for sure. And he was given a choice to work for the police or not, and he chose to do so. I never spoke to him before he made that choice. In my years at UMass from the early 1980s through about 2015, I spoke to approximately 35 students a year. But in this case, he never spoke to me, so I didn't have a chance to discuss with him the pros and the cons as to that, whether he should do that or not do that. And ultimately, he made a choice. I don't know if he talked to another attorney or not. I know he didn't speak to his parents, but ultimately he made the choice to cooperate or face criminal prosecution. He cooperated. Ultimately, one thing led to another, and he was an opiate addict at the point in time that he was cooperating, and he suffered a drug overdose at some point in time. And that's what I know about that.
What's your opinion in general of colleges using students in this way, Charles?
I don't think it's a good idea. I mean, I think confidential informants certainly have a place and have a role in our society. Certainly, terrorism, for example, organized crime. But when you think about using confidential informants for a terrorist type of organization or organized crime, usually these are trained undercover police officers with really top-notch training. They know what they're doing. They know what the dangers are. To use a student who has no law enforcement background whatsoever, it could be an art student, a music student, or just a general student, undergraduate student, I think it's a dangerous situation. We had signs around campus, kind of wanted signs. They suspected that this other individual was we call them here narcs or rats. And there was a wanted sign for him. If you see him, he's a rat, he's a narc, he's a snitch. Be careful. And then, and of course this poor guy with the wanted signs, hundreds and hundreds of wanted signs are posted across campus was ostracized.
So that was the situation that you saw at that one per student in particular at the University of Massachusetts?
Yeah, that was just one case I saw. And I'm just giving you an example if there's any hint that someone might be a so-called rat or a snitch, they're ostracized. And sometimes it's not even true that they are. just not doing this.
Right. Charles, I know you were part of a working group to evaluate the program at UMass Amherst, after Eric Sinacori died. What did you recommend?
Yes. Well, I mean, I had my own failings, but as a group, I think there were 15 or 20 of us, I think 19 of us on the group, I don't recall exactly. We recommended the pros and the cons. And, I was very strongly against the program, especially the way it had been used in the past, mostly for marijuana types of cases. So I was very vocal in the committee that this was not appropriate in those kinds of cases at all. But, as a group, we recommended these are the pros, these are the cons. And then it went to the chancellor, and the chancellor, he also had another outside consulting group giving him advice too, not the internal group that I was on and the outside group. Mostly the outside group was law enforcement officials. My understanding is they recommended very, very strongly that the program should be abolished, which was my position. And the committee itself was neutral, but he chose to abolish the program, and I certainly applauded him for doing that.
Lieutenant McCullough, can I ask you, when you think about the pros and cons of this, first, can I ask you first what you think of when you hear stories like that of Eric Sinacori at University of Massachusetts?
Well, that's just an example of why we wanted to revamp and kind of reorientate ourselves on the goals of what we wanted to do. And that was already in the process when that case actually happened. For us, and for me as a police officer, to see somebody go through our program when they come in our station the first day, they definitely have a look of addiction on their face, and put them through a program like this where they're able to prove to themselves. And I'm not talking about putting them out there as a source when we have decided not to vet them as a source, but still keep them in a program in house. To watch them come into the station the first day where they're just at the lowest point in their life and on multi substances, about 4 or 5 months later, if we can take a photo before and after, it's incredible to see some of the students come through this program and prove to themselves that they can kick this addiction. And some of them come in the last day thinking they're going to have a urinalysis test and very happy to do so. And a lot of times we don't even have to do that because we can just see the success on their faces. And we'll get letters in the mail and correspondence from them and attorneys, you know, a year or two later that say, I'm glad that your officers, authority figures took a chance and provided some structure. And it's really neat to see that. As far as using confidential sources for information, we do that. And that's something that we've had in place. And I do take a different angle on that. I've been a police officer for 18 years now. And a majority of my career was in narcotics enforcement. And a lot of that was undercover. And that is, for me, the way I was raised and the way I got into this line of work, that was out of my comfort zone initially. And to be able to go through some of those street-level buys or longer-term cases as an undercover police officer with a different identity gave me a totally different perspective on some of the safety issues and some of the angles that will be taken during an investigation like that. So it's my goal when I do have a source, whether it's a student or a non-student, to the cooperating source to use that information, but to get them out of the script as fast as possible and insert a police officer or other investigative means. Because I have been on the other side of that where I didn't want my identity disclosed or I didn't want people to know who I was. And so I do have some perspective on that, and it's something we never take lightly at UIPD where when we have somebody in that position, we want to ensure as much backstopping as possible, and it's not something we take lightly ever.
Lieutenant, you know, you were with this in the Chronicle of Higher Ed story. You were one of the few. U of I was one of the few schools. You were one of the few people to openly contribute to this. And that's, I wonder why is that transparency also important to you? It's sort of inherent in the fact that it's a confidential informant program. There are probably a lot of things you can't or should not disclose to us. But there's also seems like for you, it's important to have this element of transparency and be talking about this.
Well, we're very transparent with past cases. Anything current, we didn't want to use in that article because they're ongoing cases. But we are very excited about how this program has progressed since 2008. And it's so we like to get those numbers out. We like to talk about this because we feel like, especially in a university setting, this could be used as a model because we have gone through this and tweaked the program and as a department and as a unit gone through and we're always progressing with it. It's never going to be, we're never satisfied with what we have. We always want to make it better. So we're very excited to get it out there. So we had no issue internally putting those numbers and those stories out because of the success we have seen in it.
We just have about a minute left, Lieutenant. I just wanted to ask you, when you say that it's a model for other schools, what you want parents and students and other people listening to know about the program?
Well, the program starts at a community level where we utilize so many facets of the university and the community here. It's not just the police trying to do this. We have to bring on counseling centers. We have to bring in defense attorneys. We have to do that with the Dean of Students Office so that everybody has, we all have the same mission and the goal at the end of the day. But in complex cases like this, especially when we're addicted to we're dealing with somebody who's addicted, you know, poly drug use, that not just one drug. It is a very difficult task sometimes, but it's a very rewarding task to see kids or younger 20-something individuals at that time in their life be able to kick that addiction and just become productive members of society with a degree and a job at the end of the day.
Charles, really quickly, we just have time for yes or no. Does a program like this make you feel better about a confidential informant program involving students?
Well, certainly it was much better than the one that existed at the University of Massachusetts, where generally there was a great discouragement from talking to attorneys, defense attorneys, in fact, prohibition to discussing it even with your own parents. So certainly this is a much better program. I still don't think it should
I understand the point. Thanks for that. Charles, Lieutenant McCullough, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Nyla.
Thank you.
Thank you. The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Here's Johnny!
Hi, I'm Chucky. Wanna play?
You know, it's Halloween. I guess everyone's entitled to one good scare.
Be afraid.
No. Be afraid. Be very afraid.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
I see dead people.
You're listening to the 21st of Nyla Boodoo. I shouldn't be laughing because those are some of the most memorable moments from a few of the scariest films of all time. The Shining, Child's Play, Night of the Living Dead among them, not to mention the always shocking The Sixth Sense at the end. I will say that that's the only one of those movies I've seen because I tend to hate scary movies, but it's Halloween. And horror movies have certainly changed over the years. When we think about how many have relied on special effects and action instead of the eerie music and longer setups of the classic Hitchcock era, the way we've consumed cinema has changed too. To help you get to speed up on what to watch this Halloween, whether it's on a Netflix or streaming service or maybe even looking at your favorite scary scene on a smartphone, we've got Josh Larson with us. He's co-host of the podcast Film Spotting, previously a film critic for the Sun-Times Media. Hey, Josh, thanks for being here.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks for having me.
Katie Ride's also with us. She's a news editor at the AV Club on the line from downtown Chicago offices.
Hi. Halloween. Yeah. Happy Halloween. How are you?
Great. So you guys, no pressure, but let's start with what are your one or two favorite all-time scary films or even TV shows. Katie, what are your picks?
Oh, well, I have a solid two favorite horror films of all time. I think that John Carpenter's original Halloween is just an absolute masterpiece of the genre. The pacing in it is great, and the camera work is incredible. I rewatched it recently, and there are so many shots in there that you could frame and put on a wall as art. And it also, you know, inspired a whole, you know, genre of slasher movies, so hugely influential. My other favorite horror movie of all time is Suspiria, which is celebrating its 40th anniversary this year. That came from Dario Argento, the Italian director. And it's like almost psychedelic in parts. It's a really intense, scary slasher movie, but it's really beautifully done.
Josh, what about you?
I'm going to go from psychedelic to surreal with Nightmare on Elm Street, the Wes Craven film with Freddy Krueger, who has haunted so many of our nightmares. Just a brilliant concept that it had to work with, that if you fall asleep, Freddy will get you. And then Craven blends the real world and the dream world in insidious ways with insidious imagery. There's that shot of the figure leaning out from the wall over the heroine's bedroom that I'll never forget. And then my second favorite horror film of all time is The Blair Witch Project, which is really more bare-bones scares, you know, this found footage pseudo-documentary of filmmakers who are lost in the woods. A lot of the times what's scary about it, there's a black screen, and all we hear are snapping twigs or screams out in the woods, and we imagine the worst.
And so Nightmare on Elm Street, I wonder, Josh, you've reviewed films for years on your site at Film Spotting. What have you noticed in the way of trends today as opposed to years ago? Between, as you're saying, sort of Nightmare on Elm Street to Blair Witch Project to now?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the temptation is to say that they have gotten gorier, but really when you look at Nightmare or even something earlier, Night of the Living Dead, the first real zombie movie, they're pretty gory. They've been gory for a long time. I think what's been exciting recently are the new voices that have come into the horror genre. So someone like Julia Ducournau, who made Raw this year, she brings a distinctly feminine perspective to that horror film. And Jordan Peele had a huge hit this year also with Get Out, who, you know, Get Out is kind of becomes this comedy of code switching and social manners, or at least that's what it starts as. And then Peele takes it straight into this gore fest that relates directly to the historical African-American experience. So So I think we are getting some new perspectives and new voices coming into the genre, and that's really exciting.
Yeah, I mean, certainly Get Out is kind of one of the films that lots of people have got so much attention and chatter this year. Katie, in your AV Club article, you talked a little bit about what Josh mentioned, sort of the idea of movie options that are called feminist frights. What do you, can you describe what you mean by that?
Well, there have been a few films that came out in the past few years. I think a female director is an important aspect of this, and there have been a few notable ones. Like Josh mentioned, there's Raw, which came from, it's actually a first feature, which is really impressive because the imagery in it is so strong and so striking. And that film, it's about, it's got sexuality, but it's from a very feminine point of view, and it's also about the relationship between these two sisters, and it just treats the topic of cannibalism as a metaphor for coming of age in a very distinctly female-oriented point of view, which I think is what makes it feminist. And then there were a couple other notable ones. There was one called Prevenge that came out earlier this year from a director named Alice Lowe, British. She's a British comedy actress. And it's about a woman who's pregnant and her fetus tells her to kill people.
Oh my gosh.
She plays it like she plays it as a very black comedy. And it's something that, you know, would make, if you've been pregnant, would make you squirm, but also maybe like laugh a little bit with identifying with it, because she was very heavily pregnant when she made the movie, actually.
Okay.
Which is crazy.
Yeah.
And then there's another one that came out last year called The Love Witch, which is made by a filmmaker named Anna Biller, who specializes in taking sort of more formal, old-fashioned styles of genre films and remaking them with more modern feminist themes. And this one is about a witch who she's desperate for love and looking for love and casts spells on all these men. But, you know, it may or may not be an empty route towards personal fulfillment. I won't spoil the rest of the movie.
That's Katie Reif with the AV Club. We'll tweet out her article, by the way, if you follow us at 21ST Show. And I wanted to ask you guys about Stranger Things. I have not yet seen this Netflix show. No one will explain it to me because everyone says you have to see it for yourself. I know season 2 just came out. Mm-hmm. Everybody who loves it says it's so good. We've got a short clip. Let's take a listen.
Ah! She broke my arm. My arm.
Go.
Let's get out of here. Let's go. Go.
Yeah, that's right. You better run. She's our friend and she's crazy.
All right, that's a clip from season 2. Oh, that's from season 1, actually, of Stranger Things. Season 2 was just out. Josh, let's start with you. Are you a fan of Stranger Things? And how can you convince me to watch this? Because I feel like I'm the only person maybe who hasn't watched it. But what's so great about it?
Yeah, I can see that. Well, I haven't gotten to season 2 yet, even though it just came out.
I haven't seen season 1 yet. So, yeah.
Oh, man. Well, you should. I mean, here's what you need to know about it. Is basically, and this won't spoil anything, it's a pretty shameless ripoff of Stephen King movies and 1980s Spielberg films. But if you acknowledge that going in and can just enjoy the creativity that is within that ripoff, you know, this is nothing new. And if you've watched those movies growing up, there's a nostalgic appeal to it. And really, I'll forgive it that because it has a fantastic opening title design and theme music. I think we got a little taste of that there that I never tire of. So yeah, it kind of hits a sweet spot for those of us who remember those films, and certainly to, you know, kids who are watching it now, like my daughter, it's mostly new to them, and that way it has a freshness to it.
Katie Wood, are you a fan?
Yeah, I'm halfway through the second season right now, and I believe a more polite way to put it would be an homage to 80s films. and there's also a lot of John Carpenter in there, is another director
sure. Who's
very affiliated with the 80s era. And I think that Josh made a really great point that if you grew up with this stuff, then it is reminiscent of it in a really sort of comfort food kind of way.
Josh, Josh, you mentioned you watched it. Do you watch it with your kids? How old are they? What age range would you say Stranger Things is in the appropriate range for?
Yeah, you know, that's a hard one because everyone's kid is different. My daughter is 15, and that's the age where I got squeezed out. I would have liked to watch it with her, but she and a bunch of friends binged it together Friday night. So, so unfortunately, I'm going to have to catch up with it on my own or with my wife.
Yeah. Go ahead, Katie.
One thing I would add about Stranger Things, one way that it is, one thing that might maybe persuade you to watch it is that, you know, the style of films that it's referencing is very much there in the way it's filmed, but it also takes advantage of the TV format and the fact that you have, you know, many, many hours to play with to develop the characters more than you would see in one of the films that it's referencing.
Is it scary? Do you guys put this in the genre of scary or Halloween? Or because I feel like there's so many different subgenres now, right? Like, are we talking about like Walking Dead zombie, which is more suspenseful scary? Where would you put Stranger Things, Katie?
Oh gosh, it is scary in parts, but it's not especially gory. It's more of a supernatural monster movie kind of scary, which is right in my wheelhouse. I really enjoy that sort of thing. In terms of intensity, I don't know. What do you think, Josh,
what do you think?
Yeah, I would say it is scary. There is that monster movie element. There's fantasy going on here, too. And I think this is one of the unique things about it. Maybe by being an homage or a ripoff to all these different things, it does, at the end of the day, add up to something a little bit new, something that's a little bit of a different experience because it does straddle a lot of these genres. I would say it probably skews away from, say, like the slasher subgenre. That's maybe, unless season two heads that way, something it doesn't quite touch on. But it really does mix from sci-fi to supernatural to fantasy to monster movies. There is a lot going on.
Yeah, my very helpful producers are telling me that there's and according to Wikipedia, it's under the category of science fiction horror. So,
Okay, there you go.
There we go. So maybe not appropriate for young kids. So I wanted to ask, what are maybe, Josh, do you have some good Halloween movies to watch with younger children in mind that are not as scary and maybe more appropriate, age appropriate?
Yeah, I mean, kids do like to be scared, right? To a point that's part of the fun. And I think one of the filmmakers who's really skilled at playing up the whimsical, delightful side of scary stories is Tim Burton. And so I'd suggest Tim Burton's A Nightmare Before Christmas. This was actually directed by stop-motion specialist Henry Selick, but he was working from Burton's drawings of this character, Jack Skellington. He's the mayor of Halloween Town who wants to take over Christmas. And the movie's just full of these beautiful but ghoulish, intricate designs and funny, creepy characters, a great singing villain, the Oogie Boogie Man, who's, you know, silly at once, but also, you know, will give kids the creeps just the right amount, I think.
You know, we actually have the Oogie Boogie Man. Let's play a little bit of that.
Well, well, well. What have we here? Santa Claus, huh? Ooh, I'm really scared. So you're the one everybody's talking about. You're joking. You're joking. I can't believe my eyes.
That's the Oogie Boogie song from The Nightmare Before Christmas. We're just talking about fun movies, whether they're for kids or for adults, for you to stream tonight after the trick-or-treating is done. Katie, what do you think? We just have about a minute or so left. I wonder if you can just list maybe your top couple things you think people can stream from home tonight that we've mentioned a lot, and you guys have been great throwing out a lot of different names for us. But are there any others that you would mention?
Well, I'm going to mention, since if you want your Halloween streaming, I'm going to recommend two absolute classics of the genre. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre is available on Amazon Prime to stream for free. And that
and you can also stream for free, too, I think. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
You can stream and scream, right?
Yes. That one, it really, really... it's a proto-slasher movie kicked off. It's a lot of movies owe the Texas Chainsaw Massacre a debt, and it is authentically creepy and gross and scary. And then The Exorcist, if you subscribe to Cinemax.
Wow, you're going really hardcore with that. It's Halloween, so I guess, okay.
It's Halloween, and these are classics.
The Exorcist and Texas Chainsaw Massacre from Katie. Josh, can you give us one or two? Maybe just one. I think we're almost out of time.
Sure. This isn't gory or super scary, but it really gets under your nerves. The Hitchcock Rear Window, I think
that's
kind of a good entry point maybe to start moving into some creepier territory that doesn't really get into the gore or the explicit frights.
Right. So that is Josh Larson. He's co-host of the podcast Film Spotting. I want to thank Katie Reif as well. She's news editor for the AV Club. Happy Halloween, guys. Thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Nyla.
Thank you. Happy Halloween.
Tomorrow, we're going to continue to celebrate the fall season by talking about all the fabulous fall leaves that are out there. We'll let you know where you can best take a drive to see them. But if you have suggestions for us, we'll take calls and tweets on the air. But you can tweet us now at 21STShow. You can email us at talk@21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. We're broadcasting today from the Medill Graduate School of Journalism at Northwestern University in downtown Chicago. Thanks for listening. Have a happy Halloween.